Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show on podcasts. We have a wonderful author for you and a physician. Her name is Dr. Meredith Wadman. The book is The Vaccine Race, which is just a superb, superb history of vaccines in America and the importance of them. I'm going to start by just telling you that when we were writing the U books, Dr. Oz and I interviewed 150 people when we were talking about raising your children or you having a baby on every side of the vaccine issue. And it got so that by the end of the time after we wrote the chapter and published it, the only people that would talk to us were the CDC, who wanted us to keep, as we had in the past, publicizing the importance of the flu vaccine. But what we discovered was vaccines aren't perfectly safe. There is a risk, but the benefit is more than 40,000 times the risk for the childhood vaccines. It's like you've won a raffle or a lottery many times over. You can't get that kind of odds. And Meredith Wadman, in this book, The Vaccine Race, characterizes the history of it. And I think what I'd like to get into first, Dr. Wadman, thank you for coming on, is that it's almost you had to be a rogue and do semi-dishonorable things for the greater good.
Well, it was a different time, certainly, Dr. Roizen, and I'm so glad to be with you today. In the post-war era, meaning from along about 1945 to the late 1960s, there was a kind of a sense of medical entitlement in this country where the medical establishment felt free to experiment, for instance, with untried vaccines on institutionalized populations, meaning orphans, children in homes for the mentally disabled, prisoners, premature babies on city charity wards. You name it, any vulnerable, powerless population seemed to be fair game. And it kind of was a mentality that grew out of World War II when civilization was at stake, and so everyone was expected to do their part. But the problem is, beyond that was wrong in itself, was that the mentality did not end with World War II. And so, for instance, the rubella vaccine, that is the R in the MMR vaccine that has wiped out rubella, also known as German measles, in the Western Hemisphere, was first tested in 1 and 2 year old toddlers in a Catholic orphanage in Philadelphia, who certainly did not have the power to say yes or no to participating in that trial.
Now, I know the answer, but why Philadelphia? And tell us a little bit about where we would have been without some of the, what I would call the rogues of the medical scientific establishment of Philadelphia.
Right. So I think rogues is unfair because I think these men were creatures of their time. I mean, they include people like Jonas Salk, who invented the first polio vaccine. They were the sort of great eminences of medical research at the time.
Well, when I say rogue, I mean they had to do things that, and Hayflick is clearly one that I want you to talk about. They had to do things in the dead of night almost to be able to get progress. And that progress almost stopped and has almost stopped again. And you describe it beautiful. I mean, you portray it beautifully in this book, The Vaccine Race. So go
right.
ahead. I don't mean that rogue in a negative way. I mean it is they were willing to do things for the greater good because they believed so strongly in helping mankind.
Oh, they absolutely did. And they were ambitious for themselves. I mean, it's a mix of the power and the glory and the humanitarian impulse all in the same person because we're all flawed human beings. But in any event, what was really amazing in the mid-1960s was that in 1964, you had this unprecedented, massive epidemic of German measles descend on America. And if you or I get German measles or a kid gets German measles, not such a big deal. You might get a rash, you might spike a fever, you might have a few swollen lymph nodes, you might not have any symptoms at all. And in fact, half to two-thirds of people who get German measles don't even know they have it. But if a pregnant woman is infected, it is devastating to the fetus, and particularly in the first trimester, there's nearly a 100% chance of damage to the growing baby. And so what you had in the absence of a rubella vaccine in the mid-1960s were tens of thousands of children born blind, deaf, intellectually disabled. They had shrunken heads like those Zika babies you see today. They had holes in their hearts of various descriptions. They had combinations of these conditions. And so there was an immediate outcry, a ton of fear, particularly among women of childbearing age. And there was enormous pressure on scientists and on the government to get a rubella vaccine and to get one quickly, because these epidemics came around every 6 or 7 years, epidemics of rubella. And the 64 epidemic, no one had seen anything like it, and there was fear that the 1971 would be even bigger. And so that's the race at the heart of the book, The Vaccine Race, the race to get a rubella vaccine before the next epidemic.
And we had a history of vaccination success before that.
Oh, yeah. Polio was the great poster child of vaccine success in the early 1960s. You didn't have to look very hard to realize that, you know, kids had lined up by their tens of millions to get the polio vaccine when it first came on the market in 1955. Their parents could not get them vaccinated quickly enough because polio was a terrifying disease. It was put the kind of fear in hearts that Ebola does today. And so people embraced it with open arms. There was one thing, though, that became apparent in the late 1950s, which is that the monkey kidney cells used to make the polio vaccine had silent monkey viruses in them that could not be detected during the production process. Now, it was thought that the formaldehyde, the chemical that was used to kill the viruses before injecting it in people, also would have killed these silent monkey viruses, but it wasn't an absolute certainty. And what's more, in 1960, this unsung hero named Bernice Eddy, a woman in her 50s working quietly away at the National Institutes of Health, discovered that the monkey kidney cells used to grow and produce the polio vaccine also harbored sometimes a monkey virus called SV40. And that virus, when injected into laboratory hamsters, caused uniformly lethal tumors. So it was a scary time for regulators. They didn't know whether it would be worse to turn to some new kind of cell for making the vaccine. But Leonard Hayflick, this young working-class Philadelphian with big ambitions, who was working at the Wistar Institute, which was this elegant old brownstone building tucked on the University of Philadelphia campus, decided there had to be a better way than slaughtering tens of thousands of monkeys every year to harvest their kidneys to make a polio vaccine that may or may not be riddled with all these silent monkey viruses that might or might not do damage to people vaccinated with the vaccine. So he turned to human fetal cells, and explicitly to cells from one fetus that was legally aborted in Sweden in 1962. Its lungs were dissected at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm and then flown to Hayflick in Philadelphia, who developed from them what's known as a cell line, a self-replicating group of cells that just divides over and over in lab dishes. And once they ascertained that the woman who had the abortion had a clean bill of health, those cells effectively became little micro vaccine factories that could be used to produce viral vaccines. And so those are the cells that the rubella vaccine that protects American toddlers to this day are grown in.
Now, there it's interesting, actually, in what, 60 years, there wasn't a really new vaccine technology developed. Is that right?
Well, no. Since
recently there has. I don't mean to say since 2000, but in that period of 19 whatever it was 60 till at least 2000-2005, we were still in that same vaccine manufacturing technology.
Right, of using cells to grow viral vaccines, because viruses can't multiply outside of cells, and to make a viral vaccine, you're effectively weakening the virus and using a live weakened virus, or you're killing the virus with a chemical and injecting it. In either case, you have to produce lots and lots of copies of the virus, and so cells are the little mini factories in which that is done. I just want to trace back and add that in addition to the orphans and others who were experimented on in that era, that the woman who had the abortion that gave rise to these cells, these human fetal cells that are used to make the rubella vaccine, was never asked her permission, didn't know her fetus had been taken. And it wasn't until several months after the abortion in 1962 that Leonard Hayflick, this young scientist in Philadelphia, asked colleagues at the Karolinska Institute, the famous Swedish institute that gives out the Nobel Prize in Medicine, to please go back to the woman, who I call Mrs. X in the book, to protect her privacy, to ascertain that, yes, she was not carrying an infectious disease, that she wasn't riddled with cancer, that she hadn't given birth to other children who had other anomalies. And so that was the kind of rude awakening for her a few months after her abortion, that her fetus had been taken. And again, that was a routine thing in those days, too, for doctors to just sort of take what they pleased from patients without their consent.
And that changed. You should know I was one of the kids who got the first doses of the polio vaccine during the experimental trial.
Wow.
So I could have gotten, but they did get consent from my parents. I remember it in 19, I think it was 50, it would have been probably 54.
That sounds right. That was the year that they tried it experimentally and in large numbers of children. Yeah.
Right. So it would have been 1954. And but we were, you know, the kids were all scared. I mean, our parents were all scared to let us go out and play in the summer before that. And the vaccines totally changed parents' existence and our existence. Let's go on. Now, Hayflick escaped in the middle of the night, is one of the stories, to another place. And he also is famous for something called the Hayflick number. And you cover both of those brilliantly in the book. The book is called The Vaccine Race. And you can tell I'm having a great deal of fun talking to Meredith Wadman. She is, in addition to a great writer, I think you actually were writing for Science and Nature before you went to medical school, but went to medical school. And are you, and I didn't get the history, are you a full-time medical journalist now?
Yes, I am. In fact, I'm a reporter at Science Magazine. I'm sitting here in the Science Magazine office in Washington, D.C. right now.
See, and I get the other, I'm the other end of the, you probably don't know, I've written 9 New York Times bestsellers, including 4 number one bestsellers,
wow.
Real Age and You, the Owner's Manual, and our current book, Age Proof, Living Longer Without Running Out of Money or Breaking a Hip, if I can give my own plug for that, is I think was 3 on the Wall Street Journal list and 10 on the New York Times list this week. So I do the same thing, but unfortunately or fortunately, I don't do it anywhere near as well as you do it from a quality of writing standpoint. And so I'm envious in reading this. It's really brilliantly written.
Oh, thank you so much.
But Dr. Oz and I do write a column that's syndicated to 134 newspapers, so we have some, at least, play to do it every week. What happened in the middle of the night, if you will, why did Hayflick leave, what did he do, and what do you think the effect on vaccine development was of that, I would call it middle-of-the-night adventure.
Right. Well, you have to understand Leonard Hayflick is a very determined man still to this day. He's going to be 89 in May. And when he gets an idea, he is going to stay with it. And what happened was he was hired as a sort of a second-class citizen at this research institute in Philadelphia called the Wistar Institute. This brilliant polio vaccine pioneer named Hilary Kaprowski, who was this erudite European with fine tastes in women and wine and poetry and all math. He was a concert pianist as well as being a brilliant scientist. And he sort of looked down on Hayflick, who was a product of working-class Philadelphia, and hired him to be a service provider, essentially, to dish up cultures of cells to the brilliant cast of scientists.
So Hayflick was what we call in today's world a technician.
Right, yeah, exactly. Except that Hayflick had a PhD and was determined to do his own science. And so he, once he had derived these cells, felt very proprietary about them and handed them out freely to many, many scientists who asked for them, and also to some vaccine companies in the early 60s. The thing is that they were derived, these cells. Hayflick was on a contract to the National Institutes of Health that was signed in 1962 prior to his development of the cells, and that specified in a small print that the title for the materials developed on the contract would pass back to the National Institutes of Health when the contract ended. Well, in 1968, 6 years later, Hayflick had had enough of being treated as a second-class citizen, and he landed himself a very nice job as a medical microbiology professor at Stanford, 3,000 miles away. And at that point, the NIH said, fine, we'll have all the cells, please. You'll transfer them to us. And they even sent some folks from Bethesda in a specially equipped car to pick up the cells. And Hayflick said, oh, I don't have the inventory ready. You'll have to come back another day. In the interim, he discovered that Hilary Kaprowski was trying to sell both the cells and the recipe for making the rubella vaccine in them to the big British drug company Burroughs Wellcome. Hayflick actually saw the letter that Kaprowski wrote to Burroughs Wellcome offering this deal, and he was fit to be tied. And he thought, over my dead body, am I going to leave these cells with Kaprowski and with the NIH? I'll never see them again. And so he quietly went to the basement of the Wistar Institute after sending the NIH folks away and packed all the cells into a liquid nitrogen refrigerator, which is sort of a cylindrical bomb-looking thing, about a 100-pound bomb minus the wings, full of liquid nitrogen to keep the cells frozen, strapped that into the back seat of the family sedan of a Buick LeSabre that was a hand-me-down from his father, packed his kids into the rest of the back seat and another son up front, and off they went via the Grand Canyon to California and to Stanford. And Kaprowski was just fit to be tied. And ultimately, there ended up being a large NIH investigation of Hayflick after he began selling the cells to companies. And he sued for a title to the cells. And eventually, that was settled in 1981. And he was allowed to keep 6 vials of the cells. So they became a big issue in intellectual property about who owns cells that are created on the government dime.
And obviously, that has somewhat been resolved with more recent law. I guess it was, I can't remember who was the author, who's the, what it's called now.
The Bayh-Dole Act. Yeah, yes. There's a law. I mean, Hayflick was only slightly too early for his time. In 1980, there were lots of changes in law and in court decisions that, you know, did a 180 in terms of whether academic scientists could own their inventions, and many of them became entrepreneurs after that, and the biotechnology industry was launched as a result as well. So there was a real turnabout in that year. By then, though, he had been forced under pressure to resign from Stanford and was in the academic wilderness for a number of years before his name was more or less restored.
Now, the Hayflick number is something he came up with while working with these cells, and tell us what that is.
Sure. It's actually called the Hayflick limit, and if you ask any cell biologist, it's a very famous and fundamental groundbreaking discovery that he made in 1961 with his colleague Paul Moorhead, also at the Wistar Institute, who was a chromosome expert. And until then, the prevailing wisdom in science had been that if you grew lab cells in a dish and they died, the problem was yours. That lab cells grown in a lab dish treated properly with the right solution and keeping them from infection and keeping them at the right temperature and doing all the right things should grow forever. And in fact, that was true because most cells grown in the lab at that time, in fact, virtually all of them were cancerous. And cancer cells, by definition, will go on dividing. That's their problem, is overgrowth. They escape the normal limits on cell division. But what Hayflick realized in looking at a series of cells from fetuses that he obtained in sequence at irregular intervals from the University of Pennsylvania Hospital was that the cells inevitably died. And he thought he was screwing up at first, and then he realized, no, it's the cells from that fetus I got 8 months ago that have died, but the cells from the one I got 3 months ago are still ticking along. And after a while, he realized, no, normal cells grown in lab dishes age and die, just like human beings age and die. Normal cells are mortal. And he discovered that with fetal cells, they stopped and growing, they basically aged and then died after about 50 cell divisions. And so that number became known as the Hayflick limit. And it was really what he described is what several people won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for in 2009 for explaining why it is that those cells stop dividing and die. And that has to do with telomeres and telomerase, but that's another subject.
Well, in fact, we have the Elizabeth Blackburn and her co-author are on in 2 weeks. We'll be talking to them about the book, The Telomere Effect. And so this is a great introduction. But this is a magnificent book, The Vaccine Race, and a magnificent writer, Meredith Wadman. And in fact, she doesn't even, which is interesting, you don't even put MD after your name, Meredith. I don't know whether that's to discourage or to encourage people to not know how good you are, but the science in the book is outstanding, and in all of her work, and the writing is compelling. It's a book it's almost a page-turner book, which is really a incredible compliment to someone who's wielded or put in so much science in such a wonderful form. So I want to thank you for all of us. This is kind of like a model. You know, I used to think C.P. Snow was my model of great science writing because he could convey it in a way that motivated people. This is even better. Meredith Wadman, The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. Really important now when you look at what's happening to budgets and budgets in science as well as biotechnology. Thank you for writing this.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You've been listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. We'll be back next week with another great guest, but it's hard to top Meredith Wadman. Get it, The Vaccine Race. It's a wonderful book.